Hello, and welcome back, dear listeners, to Album to Album, the David Bowie Albums podcast with me, Arslan Mohammed. In this, the first of a two-part episode, we welcome the magnificent Mark Platy, one of Bowie's closest collaborators during that extraordinarily creative era between 1995 and 2003, when he served variously as a remixer, engineer, co-producer, studio and stage musician, and bandleader. And today he's joined by the man who supplied Bowie's beats on and on across the two decades, the phenomenal drummer Sterling Campbell. Together, these two genial gentlemen connected with me via Zoom recently from Mark's Manhattan lair to talk about Brilliant Adventures, the fifth Bowie box set of recent years, which came out this November to general excitement, covering as it does that period between Black Tie White Noise to Hours and everything in between. And also it contains, and this is the real reason I met with Mark and Sterling to be honest, the legendary Toy album. Yes, that lost collection of 60s remakes recorded in 2000 with Mark, Sterling, Gail Ann Dorsey, Earl Slick, Mike Garson and the rest of the band. For years Bowie ignored much of his Space Oddity, pre-Space Oddity material, but now, buoyed by the band's camaraderie, crackling chemistry and that great reaction to a souped-up version of Can't Help Thinking About Me that he'd been doing for gigs like VH1 Storytellers, Bowie decided to rip through some of those long-forgotten songs with muscular new arrangements. Unfortunately, the album never came out at the time, and the project was put on the back burner as work for Heathen got underway. But despite odd tracks creeping out here and there over the years, this is the first time we're hearing Mark's mix of the album as Bowie intended, and it's a superb chronicle, not only of Bowie's 60s songs, but back in 2000, when Bowie was relaxed and playful enough to have a go at redoing them with a band that he clearly, implicitly trusted to do them justice. So, in the podcast, you'll hear that we didn't quite get to a track-by-track analysis of Toy. There was simply too much else to talk about. Mark and Sterling are as entertaining, passionate, funny, and charming as you'd expect from people Bowie would want to have hanging around for such important projects as Earthling, Outside, Glastonbury, the BBC Theatre gig, Heathen, and of course Toy. I really, really enjoyed this chat, and I hope you do too. And if you do, let me know. They've got loads more stories to tell, so I guess in reality, we might be hearing more from them soon. So here we go, and enjoy. Mark Platy, Sterling Campbell, hello and welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
How are you?
Great to see you guys in sunny Manhattan. Greetings from very, very cold London. And thanks for joining me. So we are here to talk about Toy, which is going to be coming out at the end of November. Obviously, I think everyone listening to this podcast knows who you are, so I don't need to go into too much backstory here. I know when I tell people I'm going to be talking to you guys, people always bring up the story of how Sterling got into David's band through the most amazing coincidences and, you know, meeting one of the most amazing drummers of all time, in my opinion, and that sparking a career which has included so many amazing things. But that is just wonderful how Sterling was sort of... You were mentored by Dennis Davis, weren't you, Sterling?
Yeah. Dennis, it was more from just who he was and just listening to the records. He didn't actually sit me down and said anything.
Right.
All it was is I just listened to his albums, and I hung out with him.
Yeah.
And he was just funny and very welcoming. And he definitely let a lot of young people. I would see a lot of young musicians up at his house, which was my building. So I would just go up literally with unannounced and just knock on his door. And, yay, what's up, man? And you're just going to his house.
How old are we talking about here? How old were you when you started hanging out with
14,
him?
14. 14
right,
years old,
right.
1978.
And you already were really into music, and you had a kind of... Did you know the drums were your instruments at that stage?
I was about 2 years into playing drums. You know, my mother presented me with a drum kit on Christmas Day in 1976, and she saw me banging a lot. So, you know, yes, I took to drums pretty quickly, and you know, I come from a very musical family, more from a listening perspective than actually playing. I grew up on a lot of amazing music. You know, in the 70s were pretty fantastic time to be a music listener.
That was the golden age, wasn't it?
For me,
I think so.
I think so.
Definitely,
I think so.
We were so lucky to grow up in that.
Yeah, era. I mean, everybody was at their height. You know, you can, I mean, it's hard to believe what, I mean, the radio is like every week a classic was being made.
And living around here, especially around here, you got exposed to all of it.
Yeah.
To all kinds of genres. It was just all in your face. You couldn't avoid it in a good way.
Did you grow up in this neighborhood, Mark?
No, I didn't grow up in the city. Sterling is a full-on city guy.
I
was born here, but grew up in Denver, but then moved back to the New York suburbs when I was 11. We actually did listen to a lot of the same radio, just not together. Because the New York metropolitan area had so many great radio stations. And Gail's the same way, too.
Yeah.
We've had this discussion, like, you know, we were just exposed to so many things, which is why, you know, we're so comfortable kind of genre jumping, I suppose, you know, and which came in handy with David because he was obviously very comfortable with that as well.
So, Mark, what kind of stuff were you listening to when you were in your mid-teens? What were your main, who were your big bands?
Oh, Lord, that's performers. A tough one. Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. Like, that's such a horrible question to ask a musician.
Narrowing that down is really tough. I mean, you know, it's sort of...
I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, sort of what was forming your musical personality, what was forming your musical identity.
Led Zeppelin, the Commodores, I mean, anything in the middle of those, Parliament. And then New Wave came, it was got all crazy, you know, Elvis Costello and all of it. Just anything that was, you know, middle of the road, sort of album rock at the time. Springsteen, Boston, loads of stuff. Disco. It was pretty, very big, you know.
Was there a real snobbery in the music scene, though, about disco? So if you were into rock, was it kind of verboten to be into disco, too?
Not around here.
I think people secretly liked it, and they just didn't, you know, because it was such, you know, it was something that was moving in on rock, and they were like, you know, they were being threatened. But I think people liked
it
because Queen did it, and Floyd did it, and the Stones did it, and David did it.
Kiss did it. I mean,
Kiss did it. Yeah,
everybody did it.
There wasn't a snobbery.
Did Kiss do disco? Did Kiss go disco?
They did a disco song.
What was that one? It was called Da Da Da. Right. I was made to love you. Oh God.
What, a Stevie Wonder song?
That again?
No. It wasn't a Stevie Wonder song.
No.
But the point being, like, a new form of music came into play, which is another amazing thing. Like, you know, because we grew up when there was no disco. There was no electronic music. And in the 70s, you watched it form.
It grew,
And grew. It came out of this place, you know, and then it grew. And then, and just so many
It's kind of like a weird hybrid, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, like you're saying, it came out of... You have bits of it coming out of Philadelphia. You have bits of it coming out of, you know, European electro and experimental.
Well, everything was bouncing off
out of
each
R&B.
Other. Yeah.
Right. And into this mix that you were both lucky enough to grow up in, where did Bowie fit in for both of you? Were you fans? Were you aware of his music? Did it
not
was
till
it a big
70,
deal for both of you?
I knew Fame, and I, you know, that's all I knew. I just knew the song Fame. That's all I pretty much knew about it until 1978, and going and seeing him at Madison Square Garden because Dennis gave me a ticket, and. That was it. That was just, it expanded. Oh, what? You can do that with music?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the first piece was an ambient piece. Like, who was, I didn't even know what that was. I'd never been exposed to anything. And like, everything I heard, except of fame, I didn't know of David's music. And so to go from like 0 to 60 into that, that was like, I came out of,
well, that'll beat you right there.
You know, I came out of Madison Square Garden, another person, basically.
Wow. It was that profound for you.
You're talking about music in general, music was that profound.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody, like if you were into Zeppelin, you heard Zeppelin for the first time, that was profound for people. And sometimes it doesn't take a long time. If you think of the Beatles, they had, 10 minutes on Ed Sullivan and they changed everything. That's how
it's
impactful
really, at least
everything
for,
was.
I don't know about kids now because there's just so much stimuli. It's, you know, but there wasn't that much for us. That was the great thing is we had great gatekeepers.
Yeah.
And so we got to, you know, we got to hear a lot of different things, but they were very cool things.
Life-changing.
Totally.
Definitely life-changing things. Yeah. You know? Oh, shoot. Sorry about that. And also living in New York. New York, it was, you know, New York is like the ground zero. That's the place everybody wants to play, at least at that time, you know. So if you play in Madison Square Garden, you had to be Elton. You had to be Parliament. Right. You had to be Earth, Wind, and Fire. You had to be Led Zeppelin.
Awesome.
You know,
want
to talk? Yeah, Queen.
That was amazing. Yeah.
So whoever's playing there, it truly was like a mecca.
Yeah.
And that was the place where you're probably getting the most nervous on tour. You know, is to play Madison Square Garden, especially during that period.
Yeah.
And you had to be on that level to play there.
To do that.
And the same thing like Carnegie Hall. Or you know, Lincoln Center. There was always the Apollo Theater. That was always like a, you know, that's the spot where you really have to
Palladium
shine. You know,
too.
It was really important because New York.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was the top of the, that was the cherry.
At the time, yeah.
Totally.
I mean, those places are still storied. You know, if you think of the Apollo Theater, Radio City, Madison Square Garden, Shea Stadium. That doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah,
but, you know, these were...
I rode by it like a week ago. I biked by the Apollo. It's
absolutely
still there in all its glory. Yep, absolutely.
Mark, where was Bowie in your musical universe at that stage?
I believe that the first time I heard Space Oddity, I was maybe 12. And I had started playing guitar by then. And I remember that song... There was something about it that just wasn't quite normal in terms of like the way the chord went, because I was already starting to do that. I was like, but wait, why is that chord there? Nobody else does that. You know,
were you figuring out how to play it?
Yeah, I would figure out how to play records ear. And I was like, well, nobody does that chord there. Like, and then he plays it differently another time. And so that kind of stuck with me. And like Sterling, then, you know, Fame was a huge single after that. But I suppose what really nailed me was Station to Station, because we had a radio station, WPLJ, and they used to play that record. And they used to play, like, basically all of it. The whole of Stay, you would hear on the radio, which you can't even imagine today. I mean, they would play the whole song. That was like a big song.
The whole song with the big solo at the end. Smoking
the
at the end.
Thing.
Yeah.
That's kind of like what we grew up with was like, you know, these sort of epics were, they're kind of normal. It wasn't just like, well, got to cut that to 3:30. There was none of that. This was, maybe a year or two before, you know, they figured out how to kind of really commercialize radio. And they were just like playing, they were playing album sides, you know, like Pink Floyd, all the rest of it. They were just doing that. And so I really got kind of nailed on Station to Station. And from then on, I liked Lodger. I thought Lodger was pretty quirky.
That's interesting. Not a lot of people tend to go for Lodger. I really love Lodger. I think it's just one of the most charmingly wonderful, eccentric, quirky albums he did.
I thought that was...
But you don't often get people pointing to that.
I think... I thought it was a great little era too, because that was, it kind of coincided with, you know, with New Wave. And that's when he was like, you know, old wave, New Wave. And then there's David, right? And there was a couple of things around then. There was his appearance on Saturday Night Live, which was I thought, oh, even wow. when I was, yes. I think I was 17, and I thought that was genius. I was like, wow. First they, you know, he's doing The Man Who Sold the World, and they, you know, you got Klaus Nomi and Joey Aries carrying yes. him out in this thing. And it was like, who does that? Nobody does that, right? And the next time he's dressed up like a Chinese flight attendant. Is that right? When he's doing, you know, and then they have the little doggy, whatever with the, and who does that? What, you know, it was just like fascinating.
What was it? He did. I remember The Man Who Sold the World with Klaus Nomi. And then he did. Did TVC he do Ashes 1-5. To Ashes
no,
as well?
TVC 1-5.
And he right. Did, right.
What was the other one? Because this was before Scary Monster, so I forget what the third song was. Was a boys? Maybe.
But
it was
I know.
Boys
I know what you mean.
Maybe,
it was.
I don't know.
Yes, it was. It was. And I think there was a weird backwards part as well, where they play right. backwards, or there's a bit of backwards film or something. It must have been fascinating. I mean, from here, it's fascinating, given that Bowie's status in the States, I think, until Let's Dance.
Yeah.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was kind of seen as a marginal left field figure. And here he tends to be much more in the kind of in the pop, in the swim, right. really.
Yeah, other than the occasional like really big single, that's exactly right, I would think, because it would take people, you know, people like us that were, you know, tuned in to more, I guess, left field things that would be like, wow, that's, you know. There was another moment that year where, because he did a video for Boys Keep Swinging. And I remember yes. being in my basement with a bunch of my friends, a bunch of guys who were very normal, you know, unlike me, very normal kind of, you know, 17-year-old, 18-year-old guys. And that video comes on, and these guys are, they're like, ooh, you know, like appalled, you know, because he's dressing up and all the rest. And I'm like, whoa. You know, that to me, it was completely expected that he would do that.
Yeah.
So that was kind of that pointed out to me like the difference of, you know, maybe some people aren't going to get this, but I do.
Yeah, it was interesting. There's the 78 tour. Like, once again, I'm going from I have no idea what I'm about to walk into. Like, not just seeing David, but just the music and everything he's doing. So in hindsight, it's like, oh, wow, I just walked into the future. Because he was the way he was even dressing in the 78 tour, if you look at photos, he was already in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I was like, so, and it was almost like Spotify. Well, if you like this, you'll go like this. So I would go on these crate digging, anything that sounded close and remotely to Bowie. And it opened me up to like art rock completely, from Roxy to right. Japan. So my head was already in that space before like I even got to the 80s. So when the 80s happened, it wasn't too much of a stretch for me as a musician. I was already like, and it's kind of unusual because none of my friends were going down that route, you know, none of my musician friends. I was already listening to more of a European aesthetic and really like in a very naive way, because I didn't. It's like what probably the English guys thought of the blues guys. They had this very romantic notion of what that was,
yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And the same way I had, like, all I thought is like, wow, look at that, you know, look at the, you know, he looks so serious and, you know, why is his hair covering over one of his eyes and, you know, and the suits and, you know, cobblestone streets and all this stuff. And I would just imagine stuff. And I think that had a, compared to now, it's this certain longing and a certain of you using your own imagination of what it is that mm-hmm. created this thing, like the Stones, like their version of the blues. If they would have had YouTube and learned exactly how yeah. to play the blues, and they probably wouldn't have been the Stones
Not
or the Beatles, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of, for me, this kid
that creativity,
out of like,
yeah.
I, you know, you just, let's see if we put, you know, if I was a chess piece, I'm going to put you inside Madison Square Garden, David at his height, doing Heroes, who, you know, where there's all this stuff he's taking from, you know, German experimental music and adding it in, like, not having any knowledge of that, and just like, whoa, you know, it was just right. like this, it's like a Marvel comic, you know, it's just like, it was a whole nother new universe to go into. And yeah, like it as a young kid, it was like freaking Mary Poppins. It took me out of the window into this whole other world.
Absolutely.
You know, so it wasn't just about like, I just want to be a musician. I was taken on this, yeah. Like, and I'm sure, like a lot of other people, I'm sure if I saw the 78 tour, did The Cure see the 78 tour? Did Depeche Mode see the 78 tour? Did Joy Division see that? You know? So I'm...
Well, you bet your life.
You know what I'm saying?
Did.
And it's like that had a huge...
Yeah, it was a blueprint.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, Sterling, you've absolutely nailed it. I think that 78 tour and that era basically spawned a movement. You know, it spawned the whole new romantic look. I mean, he really sealed the deal with the whole Scary Monsters period. But,
oh God, absolutely.
You know, that those bands, you just name-checked those bands, and those are the bands that would go on to, you know, to use that as a launch pad, right?
Don't they forget your...
Went based
on
that.
Your friends in Duran Duran.
Of course, you know, totally.
Of course, I mean, and you played with Duran Duran,
and they were like kind of And Duran definitely set me up. So when I got to David, you know, I felt much more prepared, you know, because there was that, you know, there's definitely that connection to, you know, there's that like kind of what do you call it?
How do you mean? What do you mean in
well,
terms
no,
of?
Well, no, you know,
the
like if they're listening
stylistically,
to, you know, they got synthesizers, they got this, they got a certain sound. It's this, you know, funk against rock against ambient. Yeah. You know, it's all that stuff.
You're doing the thing, absolutely. He made people unafraid to do that. He did.
Yeah.
He kind of like propelled people to go, well, he can do that. We can do that. You know,
But it wasn't always that smooth, though, was it? Because what you're talking about, that period where he kind of defined this aesthetic that became very big in the early 80s, then I know a lot of people were baffled when he hooks up with Niall, he bleaches the hair, he gets the zoot suits, he does Let's Dance, and, you know, reading people's, you know, memoirs and things of that period, you know, the amount of bemusement, when he comes out doing Let's Dance.
You know, there's a group of people I don't want to forget, and it is Dennis, Carlos, and George Murray. They play a huge role in this, and they get so forgotten in all this. They're the spiders from Harlem, basically.
That band on the 78 tour.
Come on.
And also with Adrian Belew, right?
Yeah.
What a ridiculous band.
That's incredible.
I mean, it's incredible.
And Simon House all the guys
Roger Powell. Right, yeah.
Like, yes,
but definitely that trio of Dennis, Carlos, and George are huge. They're on all of the trilogy stuff, and they're on Scary Monsters, and partially on Young Americans and Station to Station. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I think you draw a line from Young Americans through to Lodger, and you have these guys kind of like the muscle underneath Bowie's musical evolution.
Damn rhythm section, is that what they used to?
The damn rhythm section, exactly.
And you speak to, like, I stayed in touch with Dennis until his passing, and I used to ask him about all the stuff, like, on Lodger, like, when he's playing Look Back in Anger, I'm like, what were you thinking? Like, where did you come up with that I'm going to play that. And he just, it's like Charlie Watts, why I miss Charlie Watts. He kind of shrugs,
But now you kind of know how that, things like that happen, right? You know, like... Probably he's just sitting around playing some beat, and David goes, "Hey, what is that?" You know, and then has you keep doing it, and then build something on top of it. I mean, I could totally now see where that came from, and 100 other things where it was just like some little idea floated out in the air, and he grabbed it, and that was kind of his gift. There was to just go, "Oh, that's valid.
Yes,
we can do something with that," and. Everybody else would just let it go. Wouldn't even see it.
He might not even said anything. He's just like, because like a lot of times I would do stuff and he's like, "Hey man, you know, like great." And I'm like, "What? I thought we were getting a drum sound."
Exactly.
And he just knows. Yeah. I think his magic comes later on where he's got this source material and I'm going to put something in. I'm going to make this work. Basically.
Yeah.
That's like...
He would ask you to do things.
Amazing.
And, you know, you would think, you wouldn't say, because, you know, in that position as an engineer or whatever, you don't like, you just do what people ask you to do. But I'd be thinking, what? He wants to do what? And then, you know, it would be a little strange. Like, oh, I don't know if that works. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, you go, that's not bad. And then 20 minutes later, you go, oh, wow.
You know, like hip-hop producers, like when they go, I mean, I've watched a couple of documentaries, and when they can take a record and hear something in it where they already have it sketched out in their heads what beat they're going to do under it. David was like that. He could, he can just like hear something and you can't hear it.
No.
He's hearing something completely different. And
he isolates that and he puts it in his head and he's like, yep, that's the hook. That's something for me. And he, like a magpie, isn't he? You know, he just gathers these
found
bits
sounds.
And can sound.
It's like found sounds. It's like it's like him throwing up words in the air and then piecing it together.
Exactly. Many.
I love that you mentioned the drum piece in Look Back in Anger. I mean, that is just beyond. That is. I don't know if you've seen that movie, the movie where Dennis Davis's son is. His dad recording that, or they play his dad's recording of that. And
it's amazing. And they show him playing the congas. And that's so, if you know Dennis, it's just like this just raw ability.
That's the one, yes. Tony Visconti's playing
it
for
him. I think
so
much is like forgotten what those guys did, you know, what George Murray, like Carlos's sound, George Murray, like the notes he picks, Dennis playing stuff. And then I ask him about it, and he's like, I don't know, you know. I asked him about Station to Station, and he's like, so what was that like? He said, well, David had his acoustic guitar, we sat on the floor, and he would play the chords, and I was banging out ideas on the floor with the drumsticks. Okay, and now let's go.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, bang. And then whatever came out. It's uncanny.
To go back to Stay, when you hear him coming at the beginning, that sort of like fractured, jagged entrance to Stay when everyone's coming in and that guitar lick is sort of, you know, just crashing against everyone. Dennis is unbelievable there.
And a lot of it comes out of humor, too. It's almost like like Keith Moon. It's like funny. And it just works.
Yeah.
If you knew Dennis's personality, he's just a funny dude, and he thinks in a funny. He plays funny, he plays with a sense of humor, and I think David really liked that. David loves funny.
That's maybe
sense of humor.
Something people don't really understand either. It's just how much of the working situation with him was just funny.
It was funny. 90% of my time.
Funny. He was like, you know, and if you got his sense of humor, I mean, it was fantastic.
I mean, we were watching The Office when we were making reality.
We would
record until lunchtime.
And then watch The Office.
And this is when The Office first happened, so we never seen this before. We never seen this kind of humor.
Do you mean the British one? The British one.
And,
okay.
And it was on VHS, too.
Yeah.
So just to go.
Yes.
And that was part of the first, we watched the whole series. And I remember going after eating lunch and going in to record again. And I couldn't get it together because I'm still thinking about what just happened on The Office, you know.
Right.
I'm starting to count of sores and I'm starting to crack up.
It was a lot of that. God.
It was amazing.
Sterling, did you have any particular, are there any particular gags or scenes from that you still can still make you laugh? I mean, it's such a classic series.
Oh, yes, when he's doing the motivational speech.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, get out. That's how he starts it out. And then he starts reading. Like, he says, this is some understandings from different Buddhist temper. You know, he starts doing his whole thing. And then he plays Simply the Best.
Yeah.
And then the woman stops him and he comes back. He's like, why'd you turn it off? You know? Oh, man.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And that woman comes in and she's the cleaner and the room needs to be empty now because she needs to come in and clean it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That series was wonderful. And what did David make of it? I mean, did he find it hilarious?
David all we watched was comedy. Like, everything is about Alan Partridge. Even the people, I remember, for me, the big deal, we played Wembley that year and it's Ricky Gervais is coming. You know, he was going to be there. Like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Alan Partridge, The Office. It's amazing to hear you guys sort of having such fond memories of these. They're so parochial and so British.
If you think, even, what's it?
Well, that was the thing. Growing up around here, also, Sunday nights, 10:30, Monty Python.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Yes,
right?
Yes.
I started watching that with me. I was 11 years old, right? So that'll kind of...
Me too.
That'll lead you down a path right there. So,
now you Brits messed us up.
We're very
I'm totally angry.
You know, but you had to live around here though for that. That wasn't like a nationwide thing at all. I mean, America was very, very regional at that time. I noticed that too, because I went to school in the Midwest. And, you know, like we're talking about how, you know, growing up here, we had all this different music. And they didn't.
Yeah.
They had no idea of any of this. They had like, you know, sort of meat and potatoes rock. And that was kind of it. And you marveled then, like, well, wow, how do you not know these things? But, you know, when you're in a place like this, you know, it's one of the benefits of being in New York.
But even growing up, I grew up all the way uptown, and I had no idea about downtown until I went to high school. And I
really
went to high school.
You didn't know what was going on downtown. You didn't venture.
Everything was regional, even within the
right.
city.
That's the New York. Wow. People don't get that. Like, New York is this little collection of small towns.
Yeah.
And sometimes people don't leave their neighborhoods ever for weeks or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't go north of like 34th Street that much.
I mean, I was
Well,
I think you get that way. I mean, I've lived in Berlin for many years, and now I live in London. And you know, you kind of carve out a personal village, right?
Absolutely. And then
when you live in North London, you don't go to South London.
Yeah,
it's just exactly, you might as well go to Mexico. It's like a whole different universe. Yeah. Wow. Well, it's fascinating to hear this, especially hear about your comedy.
I think that's the secret sauce in David. Even working on Outside with Brian Eno, I didn't realize I don't know what to expect. And it was just pure comedy the majority of the time being around him. It was amazing.
Yeah, totally.
I think that was the key. I mean, he, from everything I've read about him and what people have said, he had one of the funniest senses of humor, and very late in his career wasn't afraid to send himself up and to laugh at himself and to make fun of himself. And I think you need to be a very balanced and centered and contented human being to have that.
Yeah, like the making of Outside, like I think maybe people think this is a very ominous record, and maybe think David was in this place, and like we were just having a good time. We're just having fun, and you know, like, let's see what we come up with. I mean, whatever happened after that, like when David started piecing it all together, but the initial thing, there was no information. There was nothing. Like, Brian had the ideas, and David was painting on the most part. He didn't say anything. He just let you do your thing. And it's
in the studio when you guys were all there and putting it all together. He was painting.
Yeah. He was painting the whole time.
What kind of stuff was he painting?
Portraits of the band.
Oh, really? Did you get one?
I never got it, but he painted myself and Mike and
wow.
And I mean, I remember there's times where he's like, you know, he's like, doo, 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 doo. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And Brian's got all these like wild ideas every day. It was pretty fascinating, and we were, you know, and then we'll go have lunch and talk about current events and then return back to the studio. Yeah. And it was great. We were at Mountain Studios in Montreal, and it was the off season, so there was hardly anybody. I don't know, it was just the coolest setting, you know. It was
came this incredibly dark fractured album with all those sinister little voiceovers and characters,
because you would think something's wrong, you know, but like he was happy as can be.
Yeah,
that's amazing. I mean, I for the longest time I thought Outside was recorded in a dark dripping basement somewhere in subterranean Manhattan, you know, with giant rats.
It comes across like that. Well,
it's like, it's weird with artists, you know.
Yeah.
Like if that happened, like, you know, you go to Spielberg, hey, is he okay? He did Schindler's List, you know, is he all right? You know,
right.
He does something dark, you know. David could separate it. You know, he could be happy and write about dark subject matters.
I think it's partly because so many people identified so profoundly with him during the 70s. So when David was clearly in a dark place or personally in a dark place, you were getting Low and Heroes and things like that. And, you know, when superficially at least he was in a good place, you know, new record label, bright, bouncy new persona, you got Let's Dance and things. So on a very superficial level.
But even during the Low, when I speak to like, when I've spoken to Dennis about that period, I like, have Dennis, there's footage, if you go on YouTube, where Dennis is literally playing with a gorilla mask on. Just to show you his sense of humor. He had that kind. I mean, I don't know because I wasn't around the low period, but I know Dennis as a person, and he's always had this crazy, funny sense of humor. And to have that around as opposed to, like, what, pouting, you know, musicians. So I don't know. I don't even know, like, even during that period whether he was, like...
But he must have been in a pretty good place if Dennis is fooling around with a big gorilla head on his head. But the thing is, again, there, you would listen to Low and you'd be like, and especially at that time, you'd listen to Low and you think, what is going on with that drummer? What is that sound that he's got coming out of his snare drum? Because that's not a normal sound for drums, was it? I mean, that was when on Sound and Vision, on Breaking Glass, Speed of Life, you've got that incredibly distorted, crunchy snare sound that Dennis had come up with. I mean, obviously Dennis and Tony and Brian.
But like I said, I don't think he's like, you know, like I gotta go into character. You know, you just let me put this weird sound on the snare drum. Booze, whoa, you know. I think people want to make it this thing, but just knowing Dennis, like, because every time I asked him about stuff like this, it would be the total opposite of what you think it is. And after getting to work with David and Brian and just like, wait, this is we're like laughing.
That happens so much of the time. You know, you're messing around with the toys.
Yeah.
You know, and going, ooh, what does this do? And they're like, hey, stop that. That's so cool. And just running with that. It's sort of,
much of the time,
it's not a grand design on like, well, we need to get this snare to sound such and such. It's just like, ooh, try that. And it's cool. And you run with it.
It's like at the beginning of Scary Monsters where Dennis has got that football rattle and they're leading into It's No Game. And you hear that, you know, the tape spooling and then the one, two, three, and he's waving that thing around.
Just being creative.
Yeah.
They're just being creative, like, oh, that's cool. You know, I remember many times where they're like, oh, what was that? That's cool. What was that? It's just a cool sound or something.
And collecting all these happy accidents. That was a big part of it, and being aware of that.
The happy accidents. Bowie was a big, big, big proponent of the happy accidents. And Sterling, this loops back to something you said earlier about this generation of musicians and artists growing up at a period where they kind of, you know, everything went through their prism. You use the example of the Stones. Like, the Stones wanted to be bluesmen, but they were skinny kids from Dartford, right? And they could not be Howling Wolf. They could not be Muddy Waters. But they refracted it through their unique prism. And that kind of creativity, that sort of openness to experimentation and ideas, I think marked that generation of artists out a country mile.
But it's not only it's the mystery of it. Like, there's not, you know, we have Netflix, like 2 hours or whatever, on Muddy Waters and this person, you got all this super detailed stuff. These guys are like, I remember Brian talking about like him hearing doo-wop for the first time, and I tried to imagine that. What was that must have been like? Some guy from the, you know, south of England, and hearing like these guys doo-wop ding, and hearing this thing with the ambience and everything for the first time. It's mysterious, opposed to like we know the producer and we know everybody involved now, and we know how to do it. This is how it was done. He was using an EMT plate, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like all this.
Exactly. Like what you said before, we grew up in a time of limited resources where you couldn't go on YouTube and find out, oh, how did they do this part? Yeah. How did they make that sound?
Yeah.
You know, how do these people really play the songs? You had to figure it out. And sometimes you wouldn't get it right. But by not getting it right, you would take it somewhere else.
I would say you would never get it right.
Yeah, you would just be like, well, I think it's
You came up with your own thing from
you'd
it.
You'd run with it. But now it's there's so much available, which is so great in some ways, but it's just bewildering in another.
True.
You know, like you say, Netflix, like, man, I don't even know what to look at on Netflix.
But I think the pressure is on creatives now, young people especially, to be, I don't know, accurate, because all that information is so readily available. What you said just now, Mark, is like when I read about the early days of the Beatles, how they went from just, you know, messing around. They didn't really know what they were doing, but they were just having a laugh and they were trying things out. They didn't have a clue. For the longest time. I mean, I don't think anyone, I think Paul was the only one who could read music, if anyone.
A degree of training.
Right. But exactly. It was all through trial, error, inspiration, accidents. Let's see how this works.
And error. Because you're coming out of these guys, which you know, they're World War II kids. They're coming out of rations. They're coming out, you know, who's, you know, Neumann microphones. They're coming out of dudes who were in radar, who are now, you know, making consoles and all these new things, you know, that were so new.
It must have been like, and after the war, like music must have been such a sunny day after all that. I mean, that's something we can't relate to because, I mean, you know, I remember like older kids, like, you know, who'd been through the 60s would always be like, oh, you missed the 60s. It's like, well, I'm kind of glad I did.
You know,
I got my own experience out of it. But then I think back even further, like, you know, when rock and roll started and really given the environment that everyone had just, you know, the fresh post-war period, that must have just really knocked the kids on their behinds.
Absolutely.
That I don't get because, you know, I'm, you know, one of the beneficiaries of that. But I imagine that must have just blown their minds to a great degree.
Well, also like the Beatles, they're playing Hamburg of kids of parents who are freaking giving the Nazi salute. I can't imagine. I can't imagine.
Hamburg,
whoa, you know, because
really,
there's a lot to answer for from that, you know, and them being teenagers and them playing towards them, you know, like there's got to be some.
I mean, you come away
with something different. You know?
The guy who owned the Top Ten Club and the Kaiser Kello, they were all ex-military. You know, pretty, that generation was still very much in evidence when the Beatles were there. And you're right, you know, that tension must have just been unfathomable now. These young kids going over to the place where they probably lost relatives or family members fighting in the war, and now there they are going to play rock and roll. But
we got this era, you know? I'm not going to say like these kids, we're coming out of something that has the same feeling of a world war. We have a world epidemic.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm sure kids are going to come up with stuff.
There's going to be their way of adapting to this and reacting to
it. They're going to have their say on it. So
do either of you have kids? I mean, do you have kids, family who've been... Mark, sorry, Mark, you
got,
do.
He's got five kids.
Wow.
Five kids.
That's all we've got.
That's what I call them.
That's all I
call them up. I say, what's up, five kids?
That's like my theme song with him.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I got two stepkids.
Quite a surprise.
Cool. I was just saying that because I've got an 8-year-old nephew, and I was thinking that the other day, actually, just what you said now, Sterling, that for him, this must be like growing up in the war, you know, like for people of the Beatles generation. He's just coming out of this super weird time. He's too young to kind of figure it all out and understand really what has been going on, but it's been a crazy time. And everyone's been scared.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you got two different, like, two different processes. Like, back in the day, it was the Beatles, and they had an acoustic guitar, and you would do your demo on to tape of just the acoustic guitar and make the decision. Now you got kids with Fairlights on their phones with lots of
6-year-olds with Fairlights.
Yeah, 6-year-olds with Fairlights. I mean, think about that, you know, because I mean, when that first came out, it was like it cost $300,000. It cost a home to own it.
Right.
You know, you had to have knowledge of it, and you had to have an idea of what to do with it. You know, and you didn't have a library. Like you got like every library. You got Synclavier's Fairlights on your cell phone.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like I'm not saying I think they can do it. It's like how do I take all of this? Let me throw the pandemic in. Okay, we got race issues. Like, you know, let me throw all that in and make a song. You know,
it's really,
I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's a little bit of reverse engineering, maybe.
And that was part one of my chat with Sterling Campbell and Mark Platy. And a big thank you to both of them for taking the time to talk with me. So now, head over to part two, and I will attempt again to move the conversation onto Toy.